On December 13th, 2003, early hours of the morning, Delta Force captured the one guy I believe knew where Saddam was. He was the ace of spades at the time.
This is Eric Maddox, a retired Army Ranger, linguist, and interrogator whose work was pivotal in capturing Saddam Hussein. And did you catch what he just said? It's 2003, and they've just captured the one guy who knew where the deposed Iraqi dictator was hiding.
They brought him to me. I interrogated him. And in 2 hours, the one man Saddam trusted to never give up his location looks at me and said, "Eric, I know where he is, but we got to go right now." And that's how they found Saddam Hussein.
How does this even happen? When the stakes are this high, when so much is on the line, how does a person who is deemed to be an enemy become, in the space of 2 hours, a member of your team? Well, this is exactly what we are going to uncover in this final episode of Season 2. Welcome to Leading Outward, the Arbinger Institute's podcast where we explore the tools and ideas that we've used for over 45 years to help people solve their toughest leadership and organizational challenges by leading with an outward mindset, seeing people as people. I'm Mitch Warner.
In 2003, I was deployed to Iraq with the Joint Special Operations Command. I was assigned to a Delta Force team in Tikrit, Iraq. I was a trained interrogator, but I had never actually done wartime interrogations. But because I had an infantry background, I was a graduate of the Army's Ranger School, they said, "Hey, this interrogator, even though he doesn't know Arabic, he can go out with this Delta Force team." They didn't think Saddam Hussein was in Tikrit. There was a CIA case officer. He was in an accident and got shot, and they sent him out of the country. And the CIA was so convinced that Saddam was not in this little town of Crete, they didn't even replace the guy. The most important man in Iraq and the town he was captured, when the agent got injured, they didn't replace him. I start being their interrogator, and immediately it's very clear everything I was taught in the interrogation world was not going to work. It was about zero-sum game. It was about intimidation. And it was basically, "You will confess because we know everything about you." The whole purpose was to remove all hope from the prisoner. And they go, "Uncle," that wasn't going to work because this was not a battlefield. They didn't have uniforms on. They weren't part of an enemy military. And I realized, oh my goodness, how do I get these people to talk? If I do talk to people and can get them to at least open a dialogue, when I put my biases behind me to seek to understand them was when they were really open. So I kind of worked on this, and then I realized, oh, that's not sort of a thing. It's the thing.
It really is the thing. It is what matters most. It's not a technique. It's a way of seeing, a mindset. And this mindset changes the influence of everything that we do.
Now these prisoners immediately start opening up. They start telling me about the insurgency. And most importantly, they said, "Eric, we want to help you out. We want to help track down Saddam Hussein." And on December 13th, 2003, early hours of the morning, Delta Force team captured the one guy I believe knew where Saddam was. They brought him to me. I interrogated him. And in 2 hours, the one man Saddam trusted to never give up his location looks at me and said, "Eric, I know where he is, but we got to go right now." He didn't say, "Oh, I don't want to tell you. You go, maybe you'll find him." He says, "No, I'm going to take you all, but you got to take me with you because I got to show you where he is." That prisoner went with the Delta Force team I'd spent my entire tour with. They go on the raid. They could not find Saddam, and the prisoner said, "Let me show you." Takes them around the backside of the house and shows them the exact spider hole. And that's how they found Saddam Hussein.
You know, As remarkable as a story like this is, when I hear something like this, with only this level of detail, it honestly feels to me like magic. I think, that is so cool, and I have no clue how to replicate that. So today, we want to dive into the nitty-gritty, the behind the scenes, to understand how this happened, not just what happened, and to figure out, what are the steps, what are the elements of a recipe that could be followed by any of us to achieve similar results in any situation? And for me, that starts with understanding who is Eric himself.
We're all unique, right? And if somebody says, hey, Eric, what do you consider your talent? Like, my skill set is an empathy-based listener. That my talent is to look at a situation and say, this isn't right. But why? So when I got to Iraq, I'd never been to a war zone before. We're manhunting. Saddam Hussein's the ace of spades. I'm an interrogator. I got there, and really quickly, I realized they don't know where Saddam is. There's not a smart group of people who know anything about where he is. Why?
This is, frankly, a level of curiosity that is rare. To go into a situation where experts have been at work and then not assume that they have all the answers? Because really the truth is, none of us have all the answers. But what would it take to enter a situation, any situation, and not be lulled into this false belief that, well, what is happening here must be what is supposed to happen? Part of what enables Eric to do what he does is this relentless asking of the question, why?
They created this deck of playing cards. Saddam and everyone on the deck of cards was his regime. When the war occurred, he sent them all packing. He sent them all away. Saddam had this mindset where he said, wait, everybody on that deck of cards is a lightning rod. Let me send them the heck away from me. And then he'll stay by himself in this town of Tikrit. But we have this deck of cards, the link diagram, the chain of command. So we're chasing around everyone in these deck of cards thinking, the higher we go up, the closer we'll get to Saddam. I had to go, okay, who knows? Not me, but the people on the ground will. I can't force them to tell me they were prisoners. I have to make them want to tell me, die to tell me, really cherish telling me freely, free will. And now the new mindset is trust the people closest to the problem.
I'm seeing that this level of curiosity also means a level of humility that is also rare. You heard what Eric said.
Who knows? Not me.
In that humility, he respects the fact that, one, the people who are closest to the truth are those who most likely have the answers, and two, that those people have agency, that they will only tell him what he wants to know if they want to tell him.
It's always interesting to me when we look at social issues or a situation and we say, well, you know, young people should do this. You know what the problem with young people is, or you know what the problem with old people? It's like, no. You shouldn't assume what they want or what they need or what they believe. You need to ask them. Go talk to them. It was identifying the problem. Well, the problem was misinformation. And then identifying the strategy to gather that information. Our strategy to gather information since the post-World War II was to have spies in strong urban areas blend in with the local population so they didn't detect us. You go into these war zones, and that wasn't possible. So then I realized, wait a second, we don't even have the capability to gather information from informants because we don't know how to penetrate these lowly populated towns. We really don't know what we're doing. Go find who does and listen to them. I go to Saddam's hometown of Tikrit, and I realize there is an insurgency here. I don't know who's running it. Then I start to realize, wait a second, it's this little family of bodyguards. And then I realize in the family, the top bodyguard of this family is this guy. And then start to realize this guy has so much power since the war began. Before the war, this guy was a bodyguard. He didn't have any power. I mean, just do the math. You're like, this guy was a nobody. Now he's the most powerful man in the Sunni Triangle. How does he have that power?
This is so important. What we're talking about here is not just the kind of listening we do in the moment when we find ourselves across from someone. No, this is strategic. This is the detective work that is listening with a capital L. It's not just in the moment, it's listening strategically to what the entire landscape of a situation is actually telling you. Because only then can I know who to talk to, who to even listen to.
I thought maybe he's brutal, killer, intimidator. Come to find out, do you mind talking to the people? This guy's a whiskey drinking domino player, never had an enemy in the world. He's getting his power from Saddam. Saddam Hussein. It was sort of obvious, but it's only obvious if you can clear your mind of the preconceived notions of where you think he is based on all the other inaccurate intelligence coming from the government.
These preconceived notions might just be the biggest impediment to real listening. The thing that gets most in the way. Because when we are convinced of what we know, why would we ask to learn more? And what Eric discovered here plays out in every environment, not just in a war zone. Solutions that seem obvious only become obvious when we see the situation free of these preconceived notions. And this is critical for all of us, not just for those who are trying to track down the world's most dangerous dictators. This is critical anywhere where we find ourselves at odds with others, including for the president of a paving company located in Gainesville, Virginia.
We had an incredible opportunity to make this one acquisition.
This is David White, who is, as of this recording, just 6 months away from his 25-year anniversary with his company, Superior Paving.
And as I started digging through and trying to understand some of the community aspects, our team realized that there was a lot of animosity between the town, the community that is not far from this plant, and this company. Through that process, we also learned that the previous ownership really wasn't too concerned about the community's feelings or some of the things that they were experiencing, more concerned about we got to start making money. As we were going through our due diligence, we learned that one of the silos that stores the asphalt did not truly get approved. So, two issues. One, we are potentially buying a plant that has two silos, but only one is approved. And two, a community that really doesn't want us there. So, how do we influence? How do we have meaningful conversations? How do we do that with this community? We thought the right thing to do was to go and get this silo approved the right way. What that means is that the town can come back out and say, we don't want them there. A lot was at stake for us with this process. So the first thing that happens is the planning commission meeting comes up when we put in for the second silo to be approved the right way. I learned a lot that night. The community showed up and they were very upset. There was just really a lack of understanding of what an asphalt plant really is and what it does. And what it really came down to was communication.
While Eric intuited his way to an outward approach in his first wartime interrogation assignment, David's approach to tackling this high-stakes business issue in his community was guided by Arbinger's influence pyramid. We introduced this pyramid a few episodes back when we were talking about a new approach to coaching Little League Baseball, one of my favorite episodes, by the way. And this pyramid applies equally here. The influence pyramid is separated into six levels or layers, and our success at any level of this pyramid depends on the foundation to that level, the level beneath it.
At the very top of the pyramid is correcting. That's my default mechanism, by the way, is just correcting. And it's not like a hardcore correcting. It's just I want to help fix it. I want to fix it. I'm going to be results oriented. So I tend to correct.
When the need for correction seems obvious, it is so easy to start there.
What I wanted to do was address their concerns directly.
But the influence pyramid indicates that when something needs to be corrected, like in this case, the community's understanding of what an asphalt plant is, we have to go to the next layer down.
Well, the next layer down is teach and communicate. And I was like, okay, this is my opportunity to teach and communicate what we're going to do, how we can show up in the right way. Well, there's a layer below that that's called listen and learn. And I'm like, okay. Maybe I just need to listen and learn to some of their feedback. It was different for different folks. It's all situational and kind of where they are in the process. At the Planning Commission, there were people that were coming up and they were very upset. Some of them I was able to get afterwards. Some just left, got in their vehicles and took off. The ones I was able to talk to outside were very open to me reaching out and having more conversation. There was one lady that was really upset and fired up. She was the one that took off. So I asked the other folks that I had met, would you mind asking her if it's okay if I reach out to her? If you provide me her contact number, if I can call her. So they asked her, they said, hey, you're good to go. She said she'll talk to you. And so I called her and she educated me.
When we move from insisting that we educate others to really listening to them, we get educated. And it's clear in the way that David said this, that getting this education, receiving this feedback, wasn't necessarily easy.
In order to be able to receive feedback that's going to be pretty fiery and potentially aggressive, you have to care about the person. You actually have to care about what the person has to say. Having a little bit of a glimpse into what her experience has been and what her version of that experience has been caused me to care, and I wanted to be a part of the solution. You know, when I spoke with her, she had already seen my presentation at the Planning Commission, and I said, we're going to be relentless. We're going to partner with you. Just like here, you're telling me all this great stuff, and I'm learning a lot of things that I know now I can take back, and we can make adjustments. So we need to continue that partnership and have you and I have meaningful conversations, and feel free to just have at it with me. I can take it, but we'll do this together. And we're going to uphold integrity through this whole entire thing. I'll be extremely transparent with you and honest with you.
This listening was the beginning of David's influence. But who else did he need to listen to? And how would he know where to find them? This requires the kind of strategic, situational listening, that listening with a capital L that was demonstrated by Eric, applied here to this vexing business challenge within the community.
With one of the members of the town that worked as a staff member through the commission and through the town council, I knew he was someone who had influence, and he's also someone who's connected. He just knows everybody in town. Reached out to him, said, I would love to meet you. He was open to that. I came, I met with him. I got to learn a little bit more about the community, learn about the struggles they had prior from him. He said, hey, these are some people you're going to want to get to know. And he was right. So I started talking with community members, especially the ones that were extremely fired up. I reached out to them first. They were very upset about previous ownership. Didn't know who we were yet, so how are they supposed to trust us that we were going to do anything that we said we were going to do? There were some issues about sound and dust, but I addressed all those. The biggest one was odor. The prevailing winds blow towards this one neighborhood. They said they could smell the asphalt and they didn't like it. They're talking about their kids being at the bus stop and they smell it. This one lady says she wished she could open her windows again and have a cup of coffee, but she can't because of the smell. To hear that and to know that there are odor mitigating technologies in our business that can be applied and that can really help this. So I got excited about that. Like, we can show up and help.
Okay, this is so important. Despite the fact that David has the solution here, he understands that the way the community will respond to his solution will depend on the layer of the pyramid beneath listening and learning.
Below that is another layer, build the relationship. And that's where I needed to be. I needed to build a relationship first and then work my way through the process. I needed to start with some members on the council, speak with them, introduce myself as an individual before any meetings were coming up. So I started to meet with certain town officials, and then I addressed all the issues I knew about. I understand that these are the issues. And the only thing I can promise you today is that we are going to chase excellence. We will be relentless in chasing excellence in trying to mitigate these challenges that you're having. And I said, right now, these are all words. That's all you're hearing. We have to give you proven behaviors. So I had these great conversations. I said, this is who I am. This is where we want to take this. But you tell me everything you want to tell me. And I'm just going to listen. And then we'll have a conversation about what we can do together. I asked a lot of open-ended questions. I asked the what and the hows. You know, what does success look like moving forward? How can we best show up for you and the neighbors and the community in these ways? They told me we were the first ones that ever asked them these questions.
When we get the lowest level of the pyramid right, our mindset, when we see the people on the other side of the interrogation table or across the city council room as people, it changes our influence at every single level of that influence pyramid above it. And people can tell. They know when they are being seen as people. And that's what they respond to.
The next step was the town council meeting where it's going to happen or not. And that was where I had all these conversations, was in between planning commission and town council. I didn't know what to expect. I thought it was going to be like the planning commission meeting, where it was just going to be tons of people. And no one showed up to the town council meeting. No one showed up to speak against it.
When you have that foundation of working from a mindset that people matter, you could imagine in a war zone environment, especially an enemy of war, prisoners with just a number are not humanized. If you're not going to treat somebody as a human, how can I expect them to do what humans do best? And that's think and create. I don't look at it as though their information is just stuck in a database and I need them to download it, because that wouldn't be human. I need their ideas. I need their creativity. I need their imagination. They can bring that, and that's going to be much better at solving these war problems than just the flat data they have. You have to demonstrate you're listening. You have to demonstrate it during the back and forth conversation. Through picking up the breadcrumbs. Breadcrumbs are any words and statement that somebody drops out there that are the key portals of empathy to the statement they're making, the thought that they're having. So if you make a statement, if I'm listening to you with empathy, I should be able to pick up what matters most to you right now. To synthesize, I'm using the words you're using, for you. You like that. You know why? Because you're like, man, Eric Maddox really cares that I get this right. Empathy-based listening is not about being a great listener for information. It's being someone who understands the speaker's perspective for the purpose of gaining trust. Empathy-based listening is about perspective. And it's the idea that under no circumstances should I assume I know the person's perspective. That's actually very dangerous. the goal of communication exclusively is trust. It's not trust for the purpose of trust. I'm going to use that trust for the purpose of influence. And people think that's an odd word. I'm like, yeah, it is.
Why might someone feel that influence is an odd word to use in this context? I think in part because the idea that I would leverage trust to achieve an outcome that is in my own interest feels manipulative. So I get it. It's hard not to wrestle with that. At Arbinger, we draw a very sharp line between seeing people as objects, specifically as means to an end, our end, and on the other hand, seeing them as people with needs and goals that are as real as our own. So if the trust that I build is ultimately in service of some larger end, is that trust? Or is it just a more sophisticated version of using someone? This is a really hard question because we all have objectives. And because accomplishing those objectives requires us to work with other people who have their own objectives, our interactions with those people are inherently strategic. But in pushing Eric on this point, it became clear that there is an element at play here in all of this that changes everything, even with the prisoners of war he interrogates.
When we work together, my exclusive goal is to figure out what you need, get you those needs, and I believe you're going to trust me when I do that. And they're like, cool, I'm in. You're right. Eric, you are absolutely going to have control. You know why? Because I give it to you. I freely, free will give you my trust, and that is a place of power. They have useful information. Now, I want to get that information, that I'm going to do it in a manner that serves them first. And I know that sounds crazy, but as an interrogator, I've done 2,700 interrogations on 8 deployments of prisoners from 25 different countries. If all of my prisoners saw me right now, they would give me a hug. They would look at me and go, Eric, thank goodness you interrogated me. You saved my life. I addressed their needs first.
This is the key. When we are outward, we don't abandon what we need. Eric needs information. David needs a second silo approved. We don't hide what we need. It's just the opposite. We're really, really clear about what we are seeking. We're totally transparent about that. And we listen to understand what the other needs, free of any assumptions. And then we find a way to meet that need. The trust comes when we execute to deliver to them what they need.
So it's been proven behaviors at this point. Right now, we're using those odor mitigating technologies. I'm actually headed there today. We're using those technologies, and I don't want to say it's 100% gone, but when you go in there, you can't smell a thing. So we've invested in that. We've made that process happen. I talk to the community all the time, giving them updates on how we're doing and ask for feedback. A new festival, they call it Mayfest, coming up that we've never been a part of, and we're a premier sponsor, and we've had this great community outpouring now that's happened. It's just communicating and listening. You know, we acquired this business. It put us in the community, just physically, geographically put us in the community. Our team's goal is at the end of this process to be a part of the community. And that's what Superior wants to do. That's where we want to be. We're still on the journey, but I think we're on it now with the people of the community. We're just going through it together, which is so exciting.
Now, we all love a good ending, but not everything ends up with a Mayfest sponsorship. Sometimes, no matter how outward we are, no matter what we do, we run into a brick wall.
It's tough, right? It's so frustrating. Of all the interrogations that have been done since 9/11, thousands and thousands have been done. I know the percentage of break. Using the old techniques, the percentage is 4%.
Break is the term used in military interrogations to denote who, in the end, decides to cooperate.
I've done 2,700 interrogations in my career. My percentage of break is 65%. 35% did not break. Why don't they break? Who knows what the main reasons are? I can't go behind their brain and say, hey, why didn't you cooperate? Cooperation in an interrogation is a decision. Somebody has to make a tough decision whether or not they can trust me. Decisions, tough decisions, are made by leaders. The higher I go up in a chain of command, the more likely I'm going to break them. When I got the last 9 individuals towards the capture snob, I went 9 for 9 on breaking the prisoner. Once I get to that point, I can get cooperation. But the real problem, I couldn't earn their trust. They said, this sounds too good to be true. I'm not buying it. And it told me sometimes the preconceived notions, the biases they had towards me, based on their body of evidence of what they believed I would or would not do. Americans, different religions, different cultures said, I don't think so, Eric. And that's it. I mean, what am I going to do? I'm not going to beat myself up over it. You just learn from it and go, you better become better at building. I've got to even be better at this. I feel like I'm really good at being an empathy-based listener because I had a tough crowd. My 2,700, you know how much trust there is when you sit across the table from a prisoner? Not much.
This is such an important thing to remember. No matter how well we listen, no matter how deeply we empathize, how curious we become, listening is never just about our effort or our outwardness. Because the person we're listening to has agency. They aren't an object that yields to some formula. This isn't physics. Whether or not someone trusts us is their choice. And that choice is shaped by 1,000 experiences and assumptions that they carry, many of which have nothing to do with us and everything to do with how their experience has shaped the way they see the world and the way they see us. The truth is, part of seeing someone as a person is recognizing that the baggage they carry toward me personally or toward what I represent might just make it too hard for them to trust me. I can't honestly say that I see others as people without fully acknowledging this reality. Which, if anything, is all the more reason to grow as listeners. And the good news is, this is something we can get better at. As David demonstrated, and as Eric has now proved, this can be learned. As you can imagine, after Saddam was captured using intelligence that was extracted by an operator in his very first wartime interrogation mission, the world was eager to dissect just how this happened and to try to replicate it.
I was taken immediately to Washington, D.C., to the Pentagon, to the office of Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. He was the Secretary of Defense at the time. I briefed Secretary Rumsfeld and his entire team. They then took me to Langley. The head of the CIA at the time was George Tenet. I briefed George Tenet and the entire Iraqi intel team. They created a 30-person civilian interrogation team that would fall under the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I was hired as the very first civilian interrogator by the Department of Defense and was a member of that team. That's how I went on to do 2,700 interrogations on 8 deployments. But my first mission after the capture of Saddam They sent me around the world and you teach this technique. And I got to go back out there and do it again and again over the next 10 years. But it's a challenge because they don't understand the difficulty of training somebody how to listen. You know, to be a good listener, first of all, you got to admit there's a problem. The problem is we can hear five times faster than the average person can talk. So we have this excess capacity. What do? That capacity? We fill it with all these mental distractions, things we care about that distract us from what we're actually supposed to be listening to. If we remove those distractions, we have a void of information while we're communicating. We have to fill that void. You fill that void with one single agenda in a conversation. You need to seek to understand the perspective of the individual you're talking to that moment in time. That needs to be everything that's in your brain. Your listening elevates deep into the 80s and 90%. Average listener listens to 25% of what they say. You get deep into the 80s and 90s, you go over this hurdle of trust. Subconsciously, the person that you're talking to is asking themselves one question. At this moment in time, do you care more about me or yourself in this conversation? You get to a certain level of listening, the person goes, you're caring more about me than you are yourself. There's trust. Trust gives you influence. Now we have a successful interrogator.
Undoubtedly a successful interrogator, but also a successful leader, a successful employee, maybe just a successful human.
You see people as people. That's the goal. That's your organization's goal. It's always important that we break that down and say, what does that mean? What's the best way I can see somebody? What's the best way I can demonstrate that I see you as a human? Well, the best way is to give them your undivided mental attention to understand who they are, to put their goals ahead of your own. Why is that so important? Oh, it has great output. Why does it have great output? It has great output because it builds trust. You have communication and trust in an organization. You tell me how you're going to fail.
Well, friends, that wraps up season two.
We hope that this episode and everything that we've explored together this season has been deeply helpful to you. To have a conversation about how we can equip you to transform your leaders and organization, schedule a complimentary strategy session at arbinger.com. And whatever came to mind for you while you were listening, a conversation you've been putting off, feedback that needs to be shared, action you need to take. Don't wait. Take that step, because that's how change starts. We'll see you in season 3.